Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, Green Book, Race, and Politics. And Richard, we don't often dip into pop culture on this show, but every now and again a story comes along from that world that ties into what we do here. And this week, it was the reaction to the Best Picture Award at the Oscars going to Green Book, a movie that deals with a, I guess we'd say, slightly racist white man, at least at the movie's outset, chauffeuring a black man around on a concert tour through the Jim Crow South, and the two of them eventually sort of bonding and seeing past their differences. And there was a time when a movie like this and a script like that kind of fit a template of Hollywood, you know, feel-good stories about race and overcoming differences. But this year, this movie was excoriated in certain corners because it had a white director, white writers. A lot of critics said that it soft-pedaled the racial tensions that it was trying to profile. Richard, I know you saw this movie, and I know that these criticisms and the backlash to the movie on these grounds bother you. Explain why.
One of the reasons it bothers me is I was raised in the period where I actually saw these transformations start to take place. And I knew just how difficult it was for people to break their old habits and to try to readjust to a world that was going to be in many ways quite threatening to them. And if you start talking about various kinds of activities that take place with middle and lower middle class people, like the guys who are involved in this situation, you can understand that they felt themselves very much at risk. And then the question is, how are they going to start to respond? And this movie essentially both is a standard roadshow and a reversal of roadshows. The standard element is you have two people going in a car together and you see how they start to interact. And this reminds me in some sense of Driving Miss Daisy, which was the Best Picture winner at the Oscars in 1989. Very different kind of movie, but nonetheless, black, white going through Virginia and the rest of this. And so you see it. And you watch it. And what's the interesting thing about it is the kind of interesting reversals. You have the leading character in this place, Don Shalley, played by, I can never pronounce his name, Mahershala Ali, who is something of a temperamental genius. He sits on a high throne. He's obviously a genius in the way in which he plays the piano. He has a trio which consists of some guy from Russia and some guy from the United States, and they go perform. He's a Park Avenue sensation. He's a frustrated concert pianist, and willfully he decides that he wants to go on a road trip that's going to take him first through the Midwest and then through the South, and he hires a guy who's essentially a bouncer at the Copacabana in order to lead this kind of thing, and it really worked in some sense. Great acting on the part of the two of them together. They head off on the road. There's obvious antagonism between them, and then they bond over fried chicken. The dialogue is extremely smart. It turns out that our white klutz is actually a pretty smart guy in terms of street smart, and our friend Shirley has no idea what he's doing in a large number of cases. And so each of them makes the other fellow better. And when I see a movie in which people manage to improve each other, to overcome their differences and their limitations, I say to myself, congratulations. And certainly when we walked out of this movie on the Upper West Side, where the audience was, as is typically the case, Jewish and older, everybody had a smile on their face about the way the movie went. And then there was Spike Lee, and he had a big frown on his face and was evidently livid about the situation. His movie about the Klansman actually talks about the same period with the same dynamic of white and black cooperation. It was, I think, a very fine movie, so I'm not going to sort of criticize it or him. But I just thought it was petty. I think when you have films that are successful, that resonate with large numbers of people, the Oscars should be broad enough in its own vision of identity politics to be able to embrace a movie about white and black people that's done by a white person in the same way as it's done by a black person. There were sorts of arguments which said they never consulted Shirley's family. When you watch the film, you could kind of understand why. Shirley had no contact with his family. And then the author of the film or the screenplay said, no, Shirley told me he didn't want me to speak to anybody but him. So I thought, in effect, it was just a tempest in a teapot, and it's a sign of what is clearly a very raw edge in Hollywood about race relations. There's no comfort on this particular subject. It is the constant case in which you either project large numbers of black and Hispanic and Asian actors, and you systematically are trying to kind of downplay the role of most of the white type of persons, and it's a kind of a reverse racism, and generally you don't want to spoil a joyous occasion. Nobody, I hope, would say anything nasty if the Black Klansman had won the Oscar, and I was kind of sorry to see it happen in this case. And it seems to me that race relations should be getting better. I lived through the 1950s and 60s, and Lord knows they were a lot worse then than they are now. And what you see in this situation is a kind of an implicit assumption. You may think that there's been progress, but all of us wiser people know that they're not. And I think that that's just wrong. Just wrong.
So to that point, Richard, how do you process this fact that over, I'd say, roughly the last decade, we seem to have had a real tangible increase in racial tension in this country, despite the fact that, as you say, I mean, in many ways, the legitimate grounds for that tension seem smaller than ever. I mean, to what do you attribute that?
If I only knew, I would be a great sociologist. I have some very positions. I think for one thing is that even though race relations at a formal level have gotten better, there is still a genuine kind of inequality with respect to wealth, which it's much more difficult to identify. So if you're trying to look at the average net worth of a black household, it's going to be much lower than that of a white household. If you start looking at occupational advances, there are many more degrees, but when you start getting into certain professions with advanced technical skills, there's a very low black representation in them. If you start looking at political objections and objectives and so forth, it's quite clear that there are grievances associated with police brutality and similar activities. There's no doubt that things that took place with respect to Trayvon Martin and with respect to Michael Brown triggered a huge amount of response. There was that very unfortunate incident at the beginning of the Obama administration with Henry Louis Gates. And there were just too many people who were too eager to say whenever there was a negative interaction between a black person and a white person, it had to be the white person who was responsible, even if the evidence started to run in the opposite direction. And so, I mean, I could recall listening on NPR and other kinds of radio stations to the absolute concentrated outrage about the Trayvon Martin killing and about the Michael Brown killing. I think that Barack Obama did a terrible mistake when he basically, without worrying about the evidence and letting the trials play themselves out, prejudged the case and said, if I want to have a son, I would like him to be like Trayvon Martin. When the evidence comes through, it turns out that there's acquittal. It also turns out that the physical evidence that it was Martin who was the aggressor and it was George Zimmerman who was not seems to be pretty strong. The FBI writes a similar report with respect to Michael Brown and the officer Darren Wilson, which essentially exonerates Wilson of anything by saying that Brown was trying to kill him. I don't think Barack Obama did any particular service to the public at large. Instead of recognizing that situation and trying to make some amends to Wilson, who was deeply hurt, ruined in fact by this particular situation, announced that we'll never know what the true story was. That kind of agnosticism was wrong. These events, when they start to pile up, what they do is they create grievances on both sides. You get large numbers of black individuals who say, look, justice was denied in this case, we've been thwarted. And you get a large numbers of white people who say, oh my God, if no matter how clear the evidence is going to turn out to be, it's always going to be presumed in the modern situation that if there's any racial interaction, the white person is wrong. And what you need under these circumstances is presidential and governmental leadership, which tries to essentially restore the confidence in the process that run government, the trials, the investigations, and so forth, and don't try and prejudge the outcome. You then get Donald Trump into office. This is a man who's not a master of public relations. And the Charlottesville thing is a complete fiasco because what happens is he doesn't seem to understand the real dangers associated with various forms of white racism and tries to say that everybody was equally responsible in a case where virtually the information was public and nobody agreed with it. There was the rise for a while of the alt-right. Seems to have disappeared. Antifa had a slightly longer run, but even that's going down again. So what happens is you get these polarizing events, and what it's done is it creates this huge atmospheric miasma which essentially requires people to ignore all the sort of low-level processes and progress that are made in all sorts of areas, whether it's marriage, whether it's dating, whether it's cooperative works in one form or another. I think, in effect, at the micro level, race relations are much better than they were when I was young. I think everybody ought to laud that. But these large events tend to simply override that situation. You then, just to make it even worse, you start getting a strong degree of identity politics, and the Democratic Party basically goes over to one side of this particular debate and sees nothing but racism in the way in which the system is organized. There's also the correlation between race and wealth, and there's this huge impulse movement and attack on the whole situation, saying the whole system turns out to be corrupt. It's very, very hard to keep low-level relationships calm when it turns out that the larger public denunciations resonate so broadly and so wide. Twitter does not help. What it does is it means if somebody says something stupid, it gets magnified 1,000 times, always for bad effect. So that by the time you put this whole thing together, what you do is you have this kind of odd cleavage. You get a public space which is deeply divided. At the same time, at the individual level, you have a much higher level of cooperative behavior. What we have to do is to work to get that second level stronger and to try and make sure that nobody acts impetuously like a hothead when it comes to dealing with these other issues. That's awfully difficult to do in a political campaign when it turns out that identity politics seems to be, by many people, the dominant strategy for political success.
I want to pick up on that thread because you do see this identity politics impulse at work in a certain strain of the left, but also sort of beyond politics out in the culture, at least in a segment of elite culture. And it's really sort of identity politics uber alles, whether it's race or gender or ethnicity or sexual orientation. And it can be, in certain cases, so intense that it often gets expressed as a kind of a closed loop. So whatever demographic you're a part of, only those like you, the theory goes, can truly understand you or can have an acceptable opinion on issues that are of interest to your community. And if someone who doesn't have those common traits does something like you, wears the same clothes, eats the same food, uses some of the same music, that gets called cultural appropriation. Richard, how do you think about these issues? Is this – you will hear some people say that this is a real threat to cultural cohesion. You will hear other people say this is kind of an elite obsession which probably doesn't radiate out into the broader culture. How do you think about it?
Well, I think the last point is probably correct. I don't think it radiates out broadly, but the elites are so powerful in many, many ways in shaping overall public opinion, particularly at the political level, that even if you have 5% of the country which is deeply polarized, the other 95% being relatively silent doesn't alter the situation. One of the difficulties you get on the conceptual level is that it's great to say that, well, if it's black culture, only blacks can talk about it, only white culture, whites can talk about it. But many of these things interact across multiple cultures, including the movie that I just talked about, The Green Book. Well, under those circumstances, each side is entitled to talk, but neither side is entitled to say that it cannot deal with anything that the other side does. And so when you start having these proprietary claims, it's an effort to cartelize intellectual life, saying only the insiders are allowed to speak and the outsiders have to remain silent. There's an argument that knowledge only comes from painful experience and affiliation, which is deeply opposed to the positions that I've taken, which is even though I may not have personal experiences, I can read about it, I can talk to people, and I can try to understand it and make sure that the better angels and myself are able to comprehend what others say. But when they say that it's an exclusive cartel that does this, they're saying not only you're not allowed to speak, but they're saying you'll never be able to understand anything about us. And if you really take that attitude, then you're going to be exceedingly separatist, and the other side is going to be quite insulted. So I don't think that you ever want to do anything of that sort. It's also the case, I think, certainly working about universities, is that what happens is we then get this culture of sort of diversity, inclusion, belonging, and so forth, which I am quite strongly opposed to because I regard it as exactly the opposite. You have uniformity with respect to opinions, and diversity essentially always means that you're going to favor candidates that come from this, that, or the other background, and the people who are generally going to be excluded are going to be white, straight, males conservatives. I managed to pick every one of the demographic box. I'm old enough now and well enough established that I can't say that it's hurt me personally. But certainly when I start looking at younger people wanting to make their way up into the business, you see just how powerful these kinds of influences are in their ability to get jobs and to work in certain kinds of positions. If you start looking at academics, you see a huge infusion of identity politics in the curriculum. If you take something like gender studies, if there's 7,000 faculty positions on this around the United States, there's probably not one Republican amongst the bunch, and that means, in effect, that you're going to get hopelessly one-sided stuff. These people then become the hiring committees for the next generations, the tenure committees, the admissions committee, and it tends to propagate itself. And it creates a real sense of resentment by those who are generally going to be excluded. And so in many major elite universities in the United States, what you tend to see is the elites well taking care of themselves. I always like to say I know 100 to 200 parents in every class at the Harvard College. I just don't know who they are, but if I saw that roster, I can figure out that this is the elites taking care of itself. And then you hollow out the middle class, and the rest of it is filled with large numbers of diversity-type people. This sort of stuff is not lost on many people. And if you're trying to figure out why it is that Donald Trump won, it was individuals who fell into exactly this kind of demographic. They were rich enough to be outside the welfare orbit, but poor enough and unconnected enough so as to get none of the goodies that went to elite players and elite institutions, and they feel genuinely alienated and separated. It turns out that you cannot embrace your own unless you exclude the others, and I think, in effect, that the older view of trying to do these things with an eye towards race and sex when it mattered, but only an eye, and to then otherwise try to use standard criterion of merits was a viable thing. It is an extremely difficult thing when you have large amounts of public pressure, government forces, and so forth, to give a little weight to things like race and gender. There's always a tendency either to ignore it or, in fact, much more commonly, to give it such overwhelming weight that nothing else really starts to matter. And so you see many people say sentences like the following: we think that the first thing that you want in every great university is academic excellence. Second sentence is the only way that you could achieve that is through increased hiring and diversity. What they're really saying is that diversity matters and excellence does not, because the only path you could get to excellence is through diversity, and so that's the operative theory. So this is, I think, really a very, very troublesome kind of time under these circumstances. There are some reactions, but again, if you sort of look at the distribution within the elites, ask yourself how many Democratic reporters there are in the New York Times relative to Republican reporters. And the last group would probably be counted on the hand, on the fingers of a single hand. And if you start going in universities, the split is probably 85-90% liberal, and the other 10% are fragmented amongst libertarians, social conservatives, religious people of one kind or another. This sort of imbalance completely differs from that which you see in the country at large, and by virtue of that, there is a deep distrust in the way in which these established institutions start to work. And then places like Harvard, they start making fools of themselves with their finals club. And my favorite illustration of this is they say, you know, we think that every organization ought to be sex integrated. It turns out the women don't want to be in the men's clubs and the men's don't want to be in the women's club. And you force them together, the clubs tend to disintegrate. And one of the ironies is, of course, the penalty that you impose is if you don't have a co-ed organization, you cannot become the captain of a single-sex team. And the lesson here should be perfectly clear. In a mature society, you want multiple organizations with multiple criteria for admissions. And there's nothing which says that if you want to be in a women's dormitory, you don't want to appear in all sorts of other co-educational activities on professional levels. Now, that's true of men. It's true of women. At some times, the dividing line will be along religious lines. Sometimes it will be along age lines. Sometimes it will be along a sexual orientation, gay clubs and lesbian clubs. My view is you allow all of these organizations to flourish and you don't take after any of them. You will have a richer and more tolerant society because people will know that if they rest some of their times in groups that they feel more comfortable, they're not going to be excluded or scorned for everything else that they do. And places like Harvard, as a private institution, take what I think may be a legally permissible stance, but as a socially destructive one. And so I sit here as somebody who kind of liked what Martin Luther King said a long time ago about the content of character. I mean, I've always tried in my academic work to do that. The way in which I like to do it in a modern society is to say as follows. If you seek excellence, if you will find diversity. If you seek diversity, you will find mediocrity. And I think those two propositions sum up a lot of what's wrong with these universities and a lot of the elite institutions that imitate this particular pattern, Google and Facebook on some of their problems. What they do is they generate a culture of distrust on the part of people who think that the privileged insiders do not understand why they matter as well as everybody else, and they feel resentful. And that leads, of course, to the Trump type of revolution.
Before we go, let me sneak in one more question here about the sort of the policy implications of the identity politics impulse, because the left is moving so quickly these days that things that seemed fringe maybe one election cycle ago are moving to the mainstream with some speed. So, for instance, just this week that we're recording this, we saw two Democratic presidential candidates, Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren, both say that they favor of reparations for slavery. Richard, parse out for me the normative case there and the practical case, which strikes me as potentially very complicated.
This is a subject on which I've written multiple times. It is a very, very difficult subject, but let us start off with the very simple case of where reparations were tried and it seemed that they work, and then compare it to the slavery situation. At the end of the Second World War, the Germans had killed 6 million Jews, and they could not make perfect reparations to all those who were killed or their survivors because entire families were wiped out. But they were determined to have a reparations program, which went to survivors on the one hand, and then for the social losses, they continued payments to the State of Israel up through about 1958. And given the number of dead, the immediacy of the connections, the lack of anything else that had happened in the interim, one can understand why this was a kind of a political and moral necessity, and the only question was exactly how it should be organized, administered. You start looking at the slavery case, and whatever you want to say about the horrors of slavery or about lynchings in the South, it did not result in the death of 6 million people. In addition, the subsequent history is much more complicated because of all the things that happened in the interim. And so we do have a period of inexcusable segregation, which should only be condemned in the hardest of terms. But then you have an entire civil rights movement, which is dedicated much with white people to try to overcome the particular evils associated with segregation. You also have huge migrations into the United States of populations that only came to this country long after slavery was abolished, many of whom were subject to discrimination themselves. I'm thinking of the Jewish and Italian migrations into the United States in the first part of the 20th century, bringing in millions of new citizens who did not benefit from anything that happened under these circumstances. So you then have to figure out why it is that people who had nothing to do with this ought to pay. And then you also have to figure out exactly which of the people should get how much and why, given all the other benefits that have been occurred in the interim, the Civil Rights Act, the affirmative action programs, the welfare grants, the rectification made here, there, and the other place. And the whole thing starts to break down. There are too many people. The claims are too nebulous. There are too many people who are going to have to pay for whom it doesn't fit. And so what you come up with is the solution that transfer payments under these circumstances, which are so different from the circumstances associated with what we saw happen in the German situation, don't work. What you ought to do is to commit yourself to sort of removing all of the obstacles against equal and equal opportunity in employment. It is also the case that there are private individuals and private organizations which really think that the rectification of these wrongs should be something that they should take care of. They should be able to raise money and distribute it out without fear of retaliation from anybody else, and that those kinds of voluntary programs have none of the legitimacy problems associated with the coercive programs, where who's going to be charged and how much and why, who's going to receive how much and why, cannot be solved collectively. So I don't think this will go anywhere. And if it does go somewhere, there's always going to be the question of what about other forms of discrimination against other kinds of groups for other sorts of reasons? What does think about Asian exclusion? Or what does one start to think about some of the discrimination suffered by Jews or by Hispanic people? This has been a very complicated country, and it can't be that we go around having everybody pay everybody for something which we cannot define. It has sometimes been said, well, we're only asking you to return the money which you've managed to pass down through the generations, but even that turns out to be false. There are very few benefits from slavery which have endured to the present day. Sure, you could take $1 million and compound the interest over the next 150 years and assume that there are billions of dollars that were gained, but you could do that with any stream of income, including those related to railroad income or whatever else, inventions and patents. None of this stuff makes the slightest bit of sense, because most of this income was either consumed by the people who created it or dissipated in various kinds of ventures. So there's not this huge stock of wealth which is attributable to a very small fraction of the overall population, say about 7%, which could generate this vast sums of wealth. And so you don't have an assets defended theory. It's very hard to treat the current generation of citizens as wrongdoers with respect to phenomena that ended dependent on how you count. Slavery ended over 150 years ago. Segregation was formally abolished over 60 years ago. There's certainly many difficulties that remain, but I think the reparations movement is a mistake, and if one tries to push it, I suspect that the backlash will be just enormous unless the payments are so kind of on the nominal basis. Think of the following. How much money was actually given to the people who were interned in the Japanese camps in the 1940s? It took a long time to get it. They did not give it to descendants. They gave relatively limited sums. I think the symbolic elements were extremely important. I was always strongly opposed to Korematsu, but I don't think, in effect, that this is a case where the remedy of a collective nature can do better than voluntary actions by individuals and groups who think that this should become their cause.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting definingideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.